tuned in to listener-supported community radio.
A date KBOA which will live in infamy.
Tune in to KBOA on election night, Tuesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. for our live midterm election coverage. We'll have coverage that counts from local, county, state, and national races. Our anchors will be with you while the vote tallies come in, and we'll also feature analysis from your favorite KBOA hosts. That's KBOA's live midterm election coverage starting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't miss it.
Here at KBOA, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Wetlala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shwaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationships to each other and the living world.
Hi, this is Pat Matheny. You're listening to Radio KBOO.
Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Welcome, I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, Sow a Heart Farm, Regeneration and Rethinking Food Systems, host Carrie Kim will be interviewing Chef Molly Engelhart of Sage Plant-Based Bistro and Brewery, Sow a Heart Farm, and Kiss the Ground. Molly Engelhart is an organic vegan chef from Los Angeles who founded Sage Plant-Based Bistro that became committed to managing the organic waste from her restaurant, so she started her own regenerative farm called Sow a Heart. Molly recently purchased a 200-acre ranch in Bandera, Texas, to continue her commitment to food sovereignty and create community around resilient local food systems.
Aloha, this is Carrie Kim. Listeners, welcome to our show today with powerhouse Molly Engelhart of Sow a Heart Farm, Sage Plant-Based Bistro and Brewery, and Kiss the Ground. We'll be discussing her intrepid journey from organic vegan chef to regenerative farmer. She has been and continues to be an ardent advocate for food sovereignty, resilient food systems, and medical freedom. First, we'd like to thank the Tongva ancestors for their continuing presence, legacy, and stewardship of this area. Our show comes to you from the ancestral homelands of the Tongva and all of their relatives. We invite you to align with and support local First Nations, their homelands, and their lifeways wherever you live. Some 12,000 years ago, our ancestors in the Fertile Crescent turned from being hunter-gatherers to farming. Today, agriculture is associated with one-third of global land use, and food production is associated with roughly 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions. We've become largely dependent upon farming, and how we choose to farm now will surely determine the future of humanity. By increasing biodiversity, using cover crops, integrating animals, and minimizing or eliminating tillage, regenerative farming creates healthy soil that keeps water and carbon in the ground as part of their natural cycles. By supporting food production biologically without toxic chemicals, Regenerative ag serves the ecosystem and the health of all living things. Some will say it can reverse climate change, which is no surprise to those who understand soil and its vital importance to planetary health. The Regenerative Organic Alliance has a motto, "Farm like the world depends on it." Molly Engelhart joins us today to tell us how she's doing just that. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today and for your incredible example of perseverance and commitment to the planet. I wanted to start at the very beginning of, you know, how you initially went from doing your intention around organic waste management at Sage Bistro and Brewery that eventually led you down the path of regenerative farming.
Yeah, in, I guess, 2013, I watched a Graham Sate TED Talk, and it was a real awakening moment for me where I had been kind of apathetic. You know, I brought my reusable bags to the grocery store. I drove a hybrid. I owned a vegan restaurant. I drank my oatmeal latte, whatever I thought at the moment. But I was apathetic that the planet was just burning down in flames, and that not so much around like climate change even, but just like disgusting, like how we're treating our spaces, everything. It just was like, ugh. Mm-hmm. And I just was over it. I was like kind of apathetic and, you know, did what I thought I should do, but didn't have any hope. And that TED Talk really simply laid out the principles of regenerative agriculture. And also then I watched Alan Savory's TED Talk. And then I learned that food waste was the number one cause of methane. And, you know, I've been vegan and totally indoctrinated into the cow's farts were the problem.
Right.
And I was like, well, food waste is the problem. We're all doing food waste and we can all compost, even if you have a little compost bin on your patio at your apartment or you're bringing your bucket to a place, everybody is throwing away food. Right. And then as a vegan chef, I realized I was throwing away a lot of food. That's the nature of a restaurant. People are not mindful about how much they order. You have a lot of food waste. And then if you're making cauliflower, you're cutting the bases, broccoli, cutting the bases. Right. So I started to think we need to partner with a regenerative farm. So tried to find some, there wasn't any. And then I started to think, oh, you know what I need to do? I need to enroll one of my customers into starting a regenerative farm. I'd come out from the kitchen. I'd talk to every table that I thought had money. And I'd be like, it'd be like the coach of the Clippers. And I'd be like, do you want to start a regenerative farm? And then it'd be like some celebrity. And I'd be like, do you want to start a regenerative farm?
You're like Woody Harrelson. Come on.
Come on, let's go, Woody. Anybody. I was like, literally like, and I'll bring all my compost. Like, and I came to the conclusion that I was the one I'd been waiting for, that nobody was going to do this for me.
Right.
And I had no idea how. I didn't have the money. I didn't have the resources, but I just started looking at farmland. I just started trying to figure out the financing. Mm-hmm. I just really started to try to figure out all of these different things. And what I didn't know before I married my husband is that if you're undocumented in this country, you cannot get financing for almost anything unless it's a house less than $300,000. So we were totally blocked in every which way. And it took my husband, I don't know, 7 years. It just recently he became a citizen. So it was a very long process. And mm-hmm. So I just kept taking the next step, kept trying to talk to other banks, and finally I got an individual that owned some land that was willing to be the bank if I had come up with a significant down payment. And so we did that. And so the land we got was maybe not, people say, oh, how did you choose this place? And I'm like, well, it was the only option.
Right. Right. It chose you.
So we, you know, got the land and it was totally fallow. And
it's a conventional farm, right? When you inherited it.
Yes. And they had ripped out all the trees because they were going to plant something else. And then ran out of whatever steam energy money.
Mm-hmm.
And never did it. So it was just like fallow, Roundup sprayed, rocky fields and
all bare there. All bare and ground, right?
You looked at it now, you couldn't believe that in 4 years what's possible in 4 years with regenerative agriculture is unbelievable. If you look at where we are today and where we came from, it's
how you started. But it actually, your soil improved after year two, right? Didn't you already feel that you had made a big shift by year two?
Yes, we have not. At 2.5 years, I haven't purchased any inputs except for hay for my cows.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how, you know, going back to your origins around the food waste, what do you think should be happening now with food waste? Because that stream of food waste continues from restaurants. There's been no massive change around that. What do you think is the potential? I mean, of course, citywide compost already exists, but a lot of that can be largely toxic, and it's not really microbiologically sound compost necessarily. And
no. If citywide compost, unless it's managed in such a way where it's being picked up very regularly, that methane's all getting released mm-hmm. while it's in the bin rotting at 110 degrees on the side of the...
All anaerobic.
Anaerobic and disgusting. I mean, this is going to sound illogical maybe or wishful, but I don't believe the government has the answers. I believe that we've paid tons of our income and tons of our, you know, money to the government, and they have basically an open check, an unlimited amount of money, and to fix issues. And every time they fix issues, they create 10 to 12 more issues that then need to be fixed. And so I believe that we human beings have to care enough. And that is foundationally what is the problem with humans right now. Like, I have a business, I'm making the choice to spend more money, more energy, more of my life force to make sure that my food waste is being managed in such a way. We need local composting places. It needs to be something that we, the people, that is the Constitution, we, the people, are responsible. It's not for the government to do it. And so what has to happen is human beings have to care and remember that we are the people. This idea that the government, nobody's coming to save us.
Right.
Nobody is coming to save us.
Right.
If you think that the Green New Deal or the Gavin Newsom or any of that is going to save us, you are wildly missing. Like, you think I'm optimistic that people have to do it? Well, the government's had a lot of years and a lot of money to figure out a lot of things, and they haven't right. figured it out. And they throw money at stuff and it gets worse. Right. Look at the unhoused population of Los Angeles. It's gone up in 30% in the last 2 years. We spend more money, we give more resources, we expand the problem. And I don't mean we, I mean the government. But we, the people, have to decide that we care about food. We care about soil, like, mm-hmm. and we care about water, like,
Green.
Fundamentally, those are the most important things. And the government is not, they're always going to be manipulated. They always want to be reelected, and they always need money to do that. And there's always going to be a way. I mean, look at the citywide. When I started doing the compost, it was illegal for me to take the compost out of the farm. Now it's illegal to not take the compost to a farm, or when you have a restaurant, you have to compost. So they just pass laws. But the mm-hmm. problem with government is, okay, my business is struggling right now, so I need to make adjustments because the pandemic and all these things have happened. So now I need to make adjustments. And okay, we're going to have less managers, and we're going to, maybe people need to order at the counter, whatever. That's how capitalism works. If you're failing, you need to make adjustments. The government, if they're failing, they just write themselves more checks and raise taxes. Mm-hmm. And so it's literally like there's no accountability.
Right. So well, I agree with you that it's a matter of personal responsibility. But given that, do you feel that the restaurants just need to take that personal responsibility like you have to be able to handle and create a composting system? Because you know, once you become too large, it becomes a bit more unwieldy and unmanageable. And as you say, that has to be dealt with. The compost has to be dealt with right away.
So, it doesn't need to necessarily be the restaurants, but it could be an individual that's committed to composting. It could be neighborhoods. We could get you know, blank lots could be making compost. I mean, there's so many different ways that we could turn food waste back into soil. And so it's carbon sequestered, it's less fertilizers, less agrochemicals, and less methane. Like, it's just logical.
But
we've gotten so efficient, we're so efficient that we are completely not resilient. We we exchanged efficiency for resilience. But here's the thing, human beings don't care. They're sitting on their couch, watching Netflix, ordering Postmates, ordering more food than they want, leaving it out on their counter overnight and throwing it away the next morning. And it's not just me. I mean, how 50% of my food is leaving the restaurant anyways. Mm-hmm. It's every single one of us. It's personal accountability to the whole. This whole thing, the pandemic, everybody was supposed to get the jab for everybody else. Well, what about composting your food for everybody else? What about being responsible for how you consume for everybody else, and not mandated by the government? But what about just caring enough about humanity to be the best cell in the body that you can be? We're all a cell in a body. And are you, each of you listening, being the best cell in the body that you can be? Mm-hmm. And I invite you to be that cell, the most resilient, not a cancer cell that's just like taking.
I like that about the efficiency, training efficiency for resiliency. What are some of the key lessons you've learned since starting your farm? I'm sure there's a million, but just some that really stand out that, you know, have changed your life.
I mean, well, I went into it being a didactic vegan.
And what's changed?
Well, veganism is not the answer. Mm-hmm. Because, okay, we can talk about, you can look at indigenous wisdom, you can look at colonial, whatever, you go back any direction as far as you can go, there was no voluntary vegan people anywhere on the planet. People have never done that. Vegetarian, yes, in India, Hindus, vegetarian.
But they still are vegetarian, but then they eat dairy, you know, most of them.
Right, but they eat dairy. That's what I'm saying. There's no vegans anywhere. But nature needs animals.
Right.
It's the idea that we could extract, and we have. We've extracted animals from agriculture. So you see, we drive up the 5 and you see miles of almonds with nothing else.
Yeah.
Miles of cabbage with nothing else, miles of cotton with nothing else, and then miles of cows up to their knees in
right at a cow farm. Mm-hmm.
Those people are buying chemicals for their cotton, chemicals for their almonds, chemicals for their cabbage, and then that cow farmer is managing a disgusting mess of methane, gross manure with nowhere to put it. And the reality is that if those almond farmers had cows that in the winter time when the trees were dormant grazed through, they had some kind of winter rye, they could do a winter rye, winter wheat, grazed cows through, those cows would walk through, eat the grass, poop, fertilize, and then they could move to somewhere else, and then in the summertime they could be on that field where the cabbage is, and then cabbage grows in the cold season. So now then you're not buying inputs, you're not buying, and then you're not managing this huge pile of methane. If you have a cow pie in microbot in a healthy system, that's not turning septic and anaerobic and adding all this like methane to the environment. A cow pie is a treasure trove of microbiology that is supporting all of us. Like it's amazing. And so if you let it be where it's meant to be on pasture, and I have cows that are in confinement. I live in California. We have limited space, but we pick up, somebody goes every night or every other night and picks up all the cow pies out of their pen. And they get fed to the worms, or they go into our compost. So they never build up and turn into this anaerobic thing. And then you are actually utilizing this beautiful gift from the whole of this microbiology. Nothing sets off compost like the beauty of cow pies. And so I think it's really, the lesson is we got to go back to the diverse farm. We got to go back to, this guy's growing a little hay and he's growing a little wheat and he's growing a little cabbage and he has a few hogs or whatever. I mean, that is the system that worked for many years. Yeah. I came into the farm thinking nobody was ever going to die. I'm like, like everybody's going to just die of old age. And I mean, we got mountain lions, we got coyotes, we got, I mean, I remember the first time like some dogs attacked our first sheep that we had. Oh. And they were like half dead and half alive. And oh. My husband had to, and I was like, you know, my views on a lot of things have shifted. Guns. We didn't even have a gun when I first had the farm. Imagine that. But so I had to go borrow a gun from the neighbor to kill these sheep because they were like bleeding out and everything. And then I immediately went and bought a gun and was like, it's crazy to not have a gun on a farm. But I grew up a hippie in Ithaca, New York. Like, guns are bad. Like,
probably the most compassionate response you could have.
Most compassionate response. But it was terrible. I've never experienced, I mean, I have since then, because we had a mountain lion take out my favorite pregnant goat the other day. And my guardian dog got sick and he went blind, that was in the goats, and he was still in there, but he's blind. And so he wasn't working. And I was devastated. This mountain lion just didn't even take her. She was too heavy because she was pregnant to jump over the fence with her. And so then the mountain lion took a baby, attacked another sheep, and then took a baby. And you put up fences and you have guardian dogs and you trail cams.
Part of life.
Life and death will happen. And nature is so much more vicious than anything. I mean, not CAFO and all that. Like, there's two separate things, like a small farm having, but there's, nature is far more vicious than anything that would happen on a small farm. And I imagine that it would be this like utopia and the chickens would live their full 14-year life cycle.
Pastoral.
And then a hawk just comes down and grabs chicken right in front of you. And you're like, oh my God.
Molly, we're going to take a break right here and we'll come back and talk about your life on the farm.
Excellent.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Sow a Heart Farm, Regeneration and Rethinking Food Systems, with host Carrie Kim and guest Chef Molly Engelhart of Sage Plant-Based Bistro and Brewery, Sow a Heart Farm, and Kiss the Ground.
So thanks for sharing and illuminating, you know, for those who do not live on a farm or never have, they haven't seen that kind of, just the life cycle of life and death. And it can be, as you said, be vicious, can be brutal. And it's just, but that's the realities of nature. It's not, at the same time, there's benevolence. So, you know, it's just our perception. We get very kind of myopic, you know, we don't see the whole, but it is life feeding life, even in that death, it's feeding someone's life.
And there's no plate in the world without death on it. I don't eat meat. I haven't ever eaten meat. I'm 44 years old. I've never eaten meat. But every time I just had some miso ramen, there was death on my plate, even though it was vegetables I grew. And in order to protect those soybeans somewhere, there was rodents were killed in order to...
Microbes were killed in the process, something.
Yes. And if you plow a field... For example, this is an interesting thing. 25% of the diversity of the planet exists below the surface of the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine something that's a little bigger that you could imagine, like a coral reef.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you took a plow through a coral reef and then stuck some corals back down and let it grow, is that coral reef still going to be intact the way, with steel blades going through it every year?
Yeah.
Maybe three times a year. No, we are not treating 25% of the diversity on the planet as valuable and important. And it is. The microbiology in the top 8 inches of healthy topsoil is 70-something percent compatible with the microbiology in a healthy gut. Mm-hmm. We are widely unhealthy as humans. And it's not just about our personal immune system. Like, yes, but it's also our brains. Like, mental illness and autism and all these other things are now finding connections to the gut health. Mm-hmm. And then we're growing our food in these sterile environments. We're eating all these tomatoes grown in urban tower farms inside of buildings. And mm-hmm. then we're wondering why we're not healthy. Right. We are meant to be with soil. Wow. We are meant to coexist with healthy soil. We are meant to eat blackberries and raspberries and blueberries out of off the bushes the way that they are, with that little coating of yeast. If you see a persimmons or you see a blueberry, that's yeast that we are meant to have that in us.
Yes, we need that diversity of microbes. I mean, I think what you're saying too, for many people, because they don't see it with their physical eye, they don't realize it exists. People who don't know about microbiology, or they don't know that something lives in the soil and how many millions of microbes live in the soil.
And how it's connected to us, how mm-hmm. it's connected to depression, health, fertility. Someone said to me the other day at the restaurant, I'm 44. And she was like, are you pregnant again? I said, yes, I am. She said, how did that happen? I thought you didn't do any pharmaceuticals. And I was like, I don't do any pharmaceuticals. I did the old fashioned way, I texted my husband. She said, not at your age. And I said, yes. Like, but it's because I live with the soil. I live with, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying, I'm sure there's genetics and other things involved.
Sure.
My mom had me as a teenager, so I don't know if she had tried to have babies later in life, how it would be, but I'm sure that there's genetics and everything involved too. But I believe that I'm healthy and fertile at this age because I live with my hands in the soil.
Exactly. You're interacting with the virome and the microbiome every day. So that is our immunity. You know, people don't realize. You know, many are feeling, of course, economic pressure, including yourself, as we know, from rising food costs and inflation, supply chain issues. What is the inherent problem with cheap, convenient food? You gave a great video on this, and I would really like to share that.
This is not a popular view, and I'm going to be called probably a white supremacist or something for saying it, but cheap food is always abusive. The justification for cheap food is that we need cheap food to feed people who don't have the economic resources to eat cheap food. I mean, to eat expensive food.
Although they could grow food at home and that would be a lot cheaper.
But that is craziness. It every time you are eating cheap food, people and animals were abused all the way along the supply chain. And
that's why it's cheap. I know.
And it's mostly largely poor people, people of color, people in developing nations that were abused for you to have this cheap food. Mm-hmm. When you eat strawberries, not organic strawberries, I know a woman who used to clean my house and she picks strawberries. There was 8 women on this team that picked strawberries together for years. 6 of those women had some form of cancer. That is a high percentage. That she was my age. She had cancer twice. Mm-hmm. The chemicals in which people are touching for you to have strawberries that can last 3 weeks. Strawberries aren't meant to last 3 weeks in your refrigerator. They have fungus that live on them, that you should be eating that fungus, and they will mold and go bad quickly. Mm-hmm. So maybe everybody doesn't need to have strawberries every single state. You know, if strawberries don't grow, there's so many other fruits, there's so many other vegetables that are indigenous to whatever area that people are in that we could be growing. And I'm learning, I'm just moving part of my operation to Texas. Like, I didn't know anything about these black Texas persimmons that are everywhere here, just like prolific. And I did also plant some of the more traditional persimmons that people are used to, and I tried to graft some of these over. But I'm also interested, like, what is this black persimmons? What can we make out of it? Can I make vinegar the same way I make vinegar mm. out of Fuyu persimmons? Like, these mm. are, we have to learn about what grows in different places instead of trying to force ourselves to eat strawberries that were grown thousands of miles away. When I was in Mexico, so many fruits grow in Mexico. There's Driscoll strawberries from California in the grocery store in Mexico, like in, and I don't mean like in TJ right there, like that. I don't mean the Baja California. Mm-hmm. I mean in Oaxaca at the bottom of mm-hmm. the country. Mm-hmm. And it's tropical there and there's tons of fruit that grows there. Right. We have to get resilient local food systems. But again, this comes back to we the people. We the people are meant to hold the government accountable. The government is meant to be small and we are supposed to have all the power. We have to decide we want to eat local. We have to demand that. Before I had a farm, I lived in a regular neighborhood. Every inch of that place was planted with food. I had chickens and I had fruit trees and I had gardens. Like, we have to grow food. That is
essential.
Essential if we want to survive. Because let me tell you, nothing that they're growing in a lab, I don't care how eco-friendly they tell you it is, I don't care how much they say it's going to save climate change, it is a lie. Nothing that they are growing in a lab is as healthy for you as something that grows out of soil with nature, healthy.
Well, I think that's part of this disturbing trend around synthetic meats, alt meats, lab-grown meats, and sort of this whole biotech industry that wants to just bioengineer all our food. It's like the next wave of genetic engineering around food. And that is a serious concern. And we know that, you know, people like Bill Gates are big fans of this movement of kind of this biologically engineered food.
But at what point will the human body start to break down? Yeah. So we're already inundated with agrochemicals, pharmaceuticals, mm-hmm. and food that has been poisoned. And now they want to give us completely sterile food grown in a lab.
Right.
Yeah. Our body needs to interact with the whole. We cannot be sterile. Think about a baby that's born. If ask any mother who has a C-section baby and a vaginal birth baby side, which one is healthier? That baby that was born in that sterile environment is not as healthy as the baby that came out of the vagina. That is a fact. Mm-hmm. And so we're literally trying to make us all into C-section sterile. The reason that C-section babies are not as healthy is because that first going through the birth canal, the mm-hmm. vagina, the butt, all of that gets the microbiome in the baby started in the right direction. But yeah. then it's generational. So that C-section baby has another baby. Like, we're not getting people started on the right microbiology. And we can't just go to all this lab-grown meats. We cannot just out-science nature.
Exactly.
We may have a planet. And we may be evicted from the planet or go extinct, but the earth will recover without us because nature is far more resilient than we are. Right. And we're so short-sighted in the way that we look at stuff.
So what do you say, being a vegan yourself, and though you've had like all these revelations being on a farm around life.
I'm a vegetarian.
So what would you say to people who have maybe a vegan attitude that think that beyond impossible and beyond meat, all these things are actually valuable to the environment, when in reality, as we're discussing, it's a lot less healthful for you. And a lot of those fake meats are filled with canola oil and actually supporting the petroleum industry. So what do you have to say?
Full of inflammatory oils. They're full of glyphosates. They're full of genetically modified organisms. The Impossible Burger has a genetically modified organism. They couldn't even get in grocery stores for the longest time because they weren't compliant. It's not real food. And here's the thing. If it was all there was to eat, I guess, but it's not. And here's the thing. We have this huge issue where people are saying there's too much CO2 in the air. And mm-hmm. then we have this huge issue of desertified areas where we've overgrazed and the ground is bad. And then we have this huge appetite for eating meat. Mm-hmm. So to me, it seems like great. Graze animals, holistic mob graze animals, grow the grasses, the native grasses, move the animals, move the buffalo, move the whatever kind of bovine you want to use. And then those people who enjoy eating meat, eat the meat. And it's, again, it's a system that's serving all of us. Right. We have to stop having systems that do not serve all of us. And vegans mostly have the best intentions and they love animals and they want what is best, but it's a disconnect that death is on every plate, Impossible burgers, every field that you're growing soybeans in, you're killing tons of ground squirrels. And then it's like, okay, is a cow more important than a ground squirrel? What
microbes
is a sentient being? Is microbiology that we're causing mass extinctions of microbiology? Is that less important? Is an earthworm? Because an earthworm's job is massively important. So every time we kill earthworms, is that somehow less important than a cow? Or, you know, here's the thing, we have to look at all of it, and all of it is important. And we can be the apex species that shifts in the correct direction for all of us, for all of nature. The Bible talks about having dominion over the earth. I don't think it meant so that we could separate everything and make it all disgusting and full of chemicals. It is our job to, like, okay, this area needs a little love and attention. Let's move some buffalo through. Let's put some indigenous seeds down. Let's, you know, this is how we can support the whole. But we've forgotten we are part of nature. Just as much of that oak tree outside there that's filled with butterflies migrating right now, I am just as much part of nature as that oak tree is.
Yeah, I think that's very important what you're saying about remembering that we are part of the inherent cycle of life and death. And actually, you know, we can't get into these tropes of heroism, because I think that's what happens, is when a hero wise that I'm not killing anything, I'm a hero, you know, I'm more altruistic than someone else. And like you said, the intentions, they are well intentioned, but there's a lot of misperception. And if they were to live on a farm, they'd probably have a rude awakening, just as you had, about how nature actually works and that life and death feed each other.
And the privilege of living is on the backs of death. The gas you put in your car, the food that you put in your mouth, the wood that you build your house with, all of it is on the back of death. And if you cannot appreciate life, that you are living on the back of death, then you're disconnected and there is no way to separate yourself from death. You are part of that and your life is on top of that. And so we have to honor that. We have to honor the animals, the humans, everything that came before us, and then honor those that will come after us by taking care of stewarding that microbiology, that earth, that soil.
There's a huge education that needs to happen around death. We are quite death phobic society here in on this continent. But I want to shift a little bit our conversation to water.
Yeah.
At Soba Heart, you know, located in Fillmore, you were experimenting with how you could reduce your water usage through regenerative farming. And if you could share a little bit about that income, the outcome.
Yeah, we have had a lot of success in this area, and I was really interested in what I call the rainforest system. I'm not sure if there's an official name, but where you water a little bit every day at a low pressure, and then you keep the ground moist, but rather than traditional citrus and avocado farming, they are watering every 2 to 3 weeks for 48 hours or 24 hours, depending if it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks. But if you think about yourself, you would not want to go with no water for a long period of time. And then, oh, finally, I got some water. The trees are in that fight or flight stress mode much of the time when it goes that way. And so we were able to use about 50% of the water. I have a neighbor that has a similar size property, and he grew about $14,000 worth of oranges and avocados on his property with double the water that I used. And we grew about $441,000 worth of produce on the same size space. But it's not only that we water like that, but we use up every space. So we don't have bare land between the trees. All of our row crops are growing in those aisleways. So if you imagine an orchard, instead of having that bare ground or having grass between the trees, we are growing our cabbage there, or we're growing our kale there. And so when we take it out, we only ever have that 15 feet of fallow ground. And then there's these, the aisleways where the trees are, and there's grass and there's pollinators. All that microbiology can escape to the edges and then re-come back when we are replanting that. So the ground is staying healthy and intact so that the ground is also capable of retaining more water. So those are the outcomes, is that we were able to produce much more food and use much less water. Now, the downside or the argument would be, I also spent tons of money on labor. So labor is the cost that is rising when you do it the way that I'm doing it. But if you're making hundreds or thousands of times more food, it might be worth it to figure out a way how we can live in community and grow food. Because the issue is not that we don't have enough food or don't have enough space to grow the food or don't have enough water to grow the food. Mm-hmm. It's really about, we don't have enough people that want to grow the food.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break right here, Molly. We'll come back and talk a bit more about water and regenerative farming.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Sow a Heart Farm, Regeneration and Rethinking Food Systems, with host Carrie Kim and guest Chef Molly Engelhart of Sage Plant-Based Bistro and Brewery, Sow a Heart Farm, and Kiss the Ground.
Well, it's really great, Molly, to know that just the success of regenerative farming. I mean, anyone who knows about regenerative ag, regenerative farming, knows it has an amazing potential. It's just the way things are meant to be, and that plants actually want to live in communities. They don't want to live in isolation. They don't want to live on bare ground. They all interact and support each other, lean on each other. And that's the way life is meant to be. What are some of the common misperceptions you feel are being propagated around drought? I'll put the drought in quotes.
I don't know. I mean, drought, I think, honestly, we can't talk about, well, let me say this about drought specifically. So as we continue to tell people to water less and not have lawns and put in fake grass and put in rockscapes and put in this and put in that, we have to realize that no matter what you believe about climate, if you take grass that's growing and you take bare earth, one is far hotter than the other. Right. And one is aspirating moisture up into the air and the other is not. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that we should all just live in concrete jungles with no grass and not water your trees and not do any of this is actually perpetuating the lack of water that then is aspirating up into the air. There's areas in China where they have brought back the rain by terracing these mountains and making all this beautiful. So it took water to get everything going. And then that is created this microclimate in this whole valley. And it is then now bring the rain back to that area. And there is other areas that were desertified that they have brought the rain back. So I want to say that the idea that we should all be living with astroturf and rockscapes and nothing.
And mulch cover with nothing else.
and bare ground with one tree is crazy. And you can look, I just put on my Instagram recently there, we went over 115 for several days in a row, and you can see that my neighbor's trees died and my trees have almost no damage whatsoever. Like even the tiniest fresh new leaf growth has no damage on avocado trees. And that is because I have grass underneath my trees, and my trees are planted in high density planting, and they are creating this microclimate where the trees, the grass, the pollinators are all making this little microclimate, aspirating moisture, aspirating cooling. Every tree puts off BTUs of air conditioning. So the more we clear cut and have these fields, and you look at a field, they grow cabbage in the wintertime and then it sits fallow all summertime. That is heating up that area, mm-hmm. no matter what anybody thinks. It's like you could take those thermometers they were using right. during the crazy time last couple of years where they would put it on your forehead to go in somewhere, right? Those thermometers, you can take one And you can go 4 feet apart from each other at my farm where there's the road and mm-hmm. where there's grass under, and both in full sun, no shade. I'm not saying shade. There can be a 40 degree differential between bare ground and grass. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that the idea that we should stop watering trees, you see along the five, all these trees that died and they're pushing them out because the farmers didn't get allocations of water. The idea that we should stop watering trees is insane. And yeah. the more trees we have, the more grass areas that we have. Should people plant trees that need, you know, should you plant banana trees that need water every day where you only get water four times a year? No. But there is trees that can grow in almost every kinds of places.
Mm-hmm. And store water in the ground.
And then pull water from the ground and keep the water in the ground and cool the microclimate. And so what I really, really think that the main misconception around drought is that then we should use less water and we should ration water, and because it's all a scarcity conversation. Right. The idea, yeah. water, the water isn't going anywhere. The water is all cycling. But if we let the water be cycling somewhere else,
exactly.
then it's not cycling here. And mm-hmm. there is nowhere that water goes. And so, and I don't know, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a geologist, like I don't know all the exact science of it. It's scary for farmers. Like if you hear a farmer complaining about the weather next time, have some compassion. Our whole world is ruined or not ruined based on the weather. Can be, I mean, right now in Texas, we're in a very, very bad drought, and thousands of dollars of seed on the field to grow cover crops that mm-hmm. never sprouted, never came up, never, you know, sprouted and then died because the drought is so bad. Mm-hmm. And that's not, there's nothing I can do about it. There's $20,000 of seed just gone, no cover crop ever grown, no benefit to the soil. So it is hard and it is scary, but the idea that we should stop watering, stop irrigating, stop creating green spaces, stop growing food.
It's the wrong answer.
And mm-hmm. if I would say that if people could create microclimates that are cooling and making more, aspirating more moisture, holding moisture, that they should get a discount on water, that that water should be less money right. for them.
Right.
If that was to be really true. And then I would also say that there's very old, old water systems with so much leaking. The amount of water that's being wasted, you know, and then we say like, and you can't take a shower and do laundry on the same day and, you know, all these things. We have to be more willing to recycle our water,
you know,
less wasteful with our water. And our water should be going to things that make a difference, that, you know, we have, it's illegal, like to have a gray water system.
It's illegal to have a gray water system? I didn't know that.
Most places. I may or may not have some illegal gray water systems places in my life. But I'm already in non-compliance with 100 different government agencies, so don't look into that, anybody. I mean, everybody's washing machine used to go out to somewhere and water trees.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now everybody's washing machine goes into the sewer system or the septic system. Right. And that is like, we have so many ways that we can. My mother lives in Hawaii. She lives in Maui. And, you know, all her bathtubs go out to banana groves or ginger groves or like whatever, like some big bunch yeah. of trees growing.
Closed loop,
need right? a lot of water. But then you have to be mindful to not use endocrine interrupting soaps and chemicals. And, you know, I was talking to my husband about how in Mexico, they used to always have their dishwater and everything. And then they noticed the dishwasher water was messing up all their trees. Mm-hmm. I said, honey, but it's not the dishwater, it's the dish soap. Like if we send your mom better soap, she can go back to watering the
exactly. Tree. Yeah, we need to be using biodegradable products. Everything needs to be something that's beneficial for the environment, not harmful. I wanted to speak a little bit about your learning curve as a regenerative farmer. I was wondering, it sounds like you had no prior experience or knowledge when you went into it. And I'm wondering what kind of words of wisdom would you like to share with up and coming regenerative farmers or people who aspire to be such?
I grew up on a farm, so I wouldn't say I had no experience. I grew up on a farm in upstate New York, and my father's a farmer and my mother's a farmer. So
okay,
my
there you go.
Farmer in Hawaii. And people always say, well, how did you learn about everything? And I said, you know, I've been having children now. I'm pregnant with my fourth, and they're all 2 years apart. And so I've been like breastfeeding all night for however many years. And so I really just like geeked out on research and did a lot of research about stuff in the middle of the night while I'm up with a baby breastfeeding. And I would say it's 80% observation, like watch nature talk to you and show you. And but it can feel in the beginning like you're just doing everything the hardest and worst way possible.
Yeah.
And
it's more labor involved, right? I mean,
initially. Yeah, more labor, more energy.
And but he's in the end, there's less labor.
Whenever I'm like, how do you think we could do this? And he's always like, a till and roundup. And I'm like, honey.
Oh, no.
Like, and that's his joke every time. But so I'd say that, you know, the first couple of years can feel very discouraging. The produce can look really ugly and
takes not time getting to develop yields. Yeah.
I wouldn't quit your day job right away, because it is hard in the beginning and it is hard to make that transition. And that's why, you know, as disenchanted as I am with government, we are working as Kiss the Ground. We're working with this Regenerate America to shift the farm bill, because what we're hoping to get in there is that if people are transitioning to regenerative agriculture, any of their FDA loans, they could defer them in for up to, I don't know, 5-7 years as they make that transition.
Oh,
and I think that is important, because no farmer wants to be the farmer that loses the family farm. Mm-hmm. And so I do think it's important that we give people pathways. I always say more carrot, less stick. Like, I feel like the government's always like fining us or punishing us for not doing what, but mm-hmm. I'm saying, like, what about saying farmers that are doing right by the whole, by all of us, could be rewarded. We spend tons of money in subsidies to not grow food, to grow soy, to grow corn, to grow this, we'll pay you more to cut down your crop because we have too much of this year. That money could go to, if you can bring your, you know, microbiology from this amount to this amount, then we'll give you a subsidy for every acre. I think that we could create systems where farmers could sell carbon credits. I think carbon credits are mostly a lie, and you see fields and fields of trees that were planted and never watered and just died, and mm-hmm. people got carbon credits for them. But what if there was like a blockchain, and then you upgraded, and there's the trees and there's the soil reports, and every
you can actually
year
have the accountability for it.
There's an accountability, but then there's some entity like a Delta Airlines or whatever that's paying that farmer additionally to the crops and stuff that they're growing for offsetting what they might be doing. And so I think there is a way to have, you know, through the blockchain and have great accountability and support and subsidize farmers. And it doesn't even necessarily need to be government. It can be private industry subsidizing through, you know, offsetting what they're doing with other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Your experience in Fillmore, just what you had done with water and the regenerative farming, were other farms inspired by what you're doing, or are they more kind of on that dole of subsidies or inputs? And, you know, wondering, were other farmers inspired to learn what you were doing because you were succeeding?
I think that people were very skeptical at first, and people are much more interested now. And I had this older gentleman, I won't say his name, but that runs a huge, like bajillions of acres of avocado. And he said to me, he said, people might not be paying attention today, Molly, but in the next 5 years, the work you're doing here is going to be really important and is going to support the rest of us in deciding how we move forward. And so I think that some people are seeing, but I sent out the pictures a couple of weeks ago of like my trees versus the neighbor's trees with the heat. And some people were like, wow. And other farmers were like, well, what's the genetics of that tree and that tree and what rootstock, and wanting there to be some reason besides the grass.
Uh-huh.
Because it's easy to spray Roundup.
Right, sure. Well, it's convenient. I mean, I think that's another thing about society here. Mm-hmm. We're kind of addicted to convenience, and labor is a hard thing, you know.
And we have to be stronger. Like, we have to create, what is that saying? Like, strong men create good times create weak men, mm-hmm. weak men create bad times, and bad times create. I mean, I think we're in a time of weak men, and or men and women, and we need to it's going to be hard times coming here, and that hard times is going to create stronger people, I guess. But we as humans have every option. People go, oh, well, the privilege, you have the privilege and the this or that to have the farm. And I live with 27 people on land, and they all have the same access to the land. Like, they all are getting to eat off the land. They're all getting to grow food on the land. Like, community doesn't need to be, yes, we have to combine resources, but this idea of we all need our own square with our own house and our own swimming pool and our own space, that, as much as we like it, is not natural. And
that's a big disconnect.
Yeah. And that's a huge disconnect. And it doesn't work. We must live in, for us to thrive, we have to live in community and we have to support each other. No man is an island. But things, the way the world has gotten, people think they don't need anybody, but they don't, because they don't identify as the guy at Amazon or the child in Indonesia sewing their clothes, or, you know, the truck driver that's driving it, or the ship driver that's, I mean, they are not existing alone. They are in a community. They're just not acknowledging, participating, or being with that community. Mm-hmm. And I think growing our own food is one of the closest ways to be to with God or nature or universe or spirit, whatever word works for you, because you are in that flow of abundance of nature is constantly expressing. Mm-hmm. And then you get to see, right. But it's effort in, effort out. We must put effort in to get effort out. And unfortunately, we've been able to extract a lot without much effort in, because we've outsourced the effort. And mm-hmm. I think it's time that we, the people, start putting our own effort in.
That's the reciprocity, sacred reciprocity. Molly, thank you so much for all that you give to the world, and just for being this example of regenerative farming in the world and inspiring many people with that. Could you share how people can stay connected with you and follow what you're doing? Where should they?
Yeah, for sure. My restaurant is called Sage Plant-Based Bistros and Brewery in Los Angeles, and we have a website. And the Instagram for the restaurant is The Kind Sage. And the Instagram for me is Chef Molly. And the Instagram for the farm is Sew a Heart. And the new farm in Texas, if you want to follow along from the beginning of a project as it goes through the process, is Sewing Sovereignty on Instagram as well. And so we are here, and we will be creating healthy food systems in local spaces and hoping to inspire others to grow their own food and learn how to do stuff in the real, not in the metaverse, in the microbiology verse.
In the soil.
In the soil verse.
Yeah, soil verse. Microbiology.
In the nature verse. So I encourage everybody to do that. And thank you for listening. And I hope that we can connect, you can connect with any of those things in the future.
Thank you again, Molly. Yeah, more power to you and to the new farm in Texas as well.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Hey, listeners, if you want to check out the extended recording of the show, go to our website at ecojusticeradio.org. Thank you to our guest, Chef Molly Engelhart, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. This has been Sew a Heart Farm, Regeneration and Rethinking Food Systems. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal 350, or Adventures in Waste. And if you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You've been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. Executive producer Jack Eyte, producer and co-host Jessica Aldrich, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.